This is Sam Edwards, proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network, SurreyFarms.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
The program was sponsored by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Summertime is not the only time when barbecue is welcome. At S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, Sam Edwards has been working his magic on ribs, briskets, pit-cooked pulled pork, and much, much more. Add a few of their sides and the party is complete. Entertaining has never been so easy. To order, go to virginiatraditions.com.
Woo! Woo!
That is the
Lead track
off the new Snacky Tunes.
Well, technically the second track.
Right, after the intro. Live, out tomorrow. You can download it for free on our website, fotpnyc.com. And yeah, it'll be great. And we'll be sending out email blasts about it and everything. So yeah,
we're going to be celebrating things at the City Winery, June 30th. Tickets on sale, and also for the Thrills VIP Hour.
Yeah, so go to citywinery.com. Or go to thrillist.com to get your tickets for the barbecue. 8 chefs, 3 bands. We'll be DJing.
Can't wait.
Be awesome. But today.
Today. We have Michael H. Endelman.
Is the H necessary?
It isn't, but it's fine.
Is your name a common name that you need the middle initial?
It's not a common name, actually, yeah.
When I researched you, are you the same squash player? that I found on my... do you play squash?
I am that same very, very mediocre squash player.
Yeah. I play. We should play.
Let's play.
All right.
Where do you play?
City View.
Nice. Fancy.
At Lions. Well, I used to be a printing house, and then printing house got taken over by Equinox. Where do you play? Lincoln Center?
No. New York Sports Club, Cobble Hill.
Oh, okay. Nice courts?
No. No.
All right.
We should save this for the squash hour.
It's in there. Yeah, it's in there. So, Michael, you are the features editor at Food & Wine Magazine. What does that entail?
I edit a lot of the things that are a little bit longer in the magazine. I edit profiles and essays and some travel stories. That's sort of my main beat. But I also, just help top edit lots of copy that comes in through the magazine, regular columns, and help package things and just shape the magazine's content.
How much are you reading a week?
How much am I reading?
Yeah.
Oh, I read a lot. I mean, I subscribe to basically every magazine, all the main magazines you could think of, newspapers. I'm a Twitter fiend, so I read a lot. And then, in terms of what I read, in terms of actual stories, I don't know. I mean, a week, like this week, we're shipping an issue. I'll be reading, 10, 15 stories or something like that. Some are long. Some are 2,000-3,000 words or 2,000 words. Some are little, 10-word little blurbs. But it's just part of the job.
It just adds up.
It does add up.
How much do you retain?
I retain a lot. I think that's one reason I'm good. The editing thing, magazines, is good for me because I have a crazy memory for esoterica. I remember lots of sort of random stuff.
Wait, for the other magazines that you read, like they're obviously in other areas that are not food.
Yeah.
What are you looking for to bring into your editing style?
I mean, when I read other magazines, I'm kind of looking for a couple things. I mean, this is, I'm just one looking for writers. I want to know who the cool, interesting writers are, whether they're people I know of, who I want to hear what they're up to, or new people. So you're always like looking for new writers.
Want to give a shout out to a new writer that you've been enjoying? Or is that
Well, the problem is, the story that I most read recently that I loved is not a new writer, or he's a very famous writer. He's just amazing. It's David Gran, who writes for The New Yorker, who writes these crazy stories which take him like a year or a year, 18 months to research and write.
Let me ask you those things, because I was, fan of The New Yorker growing up. When you get The New Yorker and it's like a quarter of The New Yorker, it's a story, and obviously, like, how does that writer do it? A, and B, how do they live off of that? Because it's obviously like all consuming. That's all they did.
Magazines, Food & Wine does do this that much, but a lot of magazines have just writers on sort of a contract. You get paid a certain amount a month to write for them, and you get that your check every month, so you just live off that.
But even if you only produce like one or two stories a year?
Yeah. Well, they... A lot of magazines pay per word, so you get paid, let's say, a fee, you 50,000 words a year, and so they just pay you out every month. And so as long as you have to meet that quota,
I got it.
I mean, when I was at Rolling Stone, we used to count people's word counts to say, oh, have they met their quota yet? You have to, count that up.
Let's talk about Rolling Stone.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about your career before you got into the food world.
Sure.
Because, a lot of the food guys we have on this show, they used to all be into music.
Right. Yeah.
They're still into music. They used to work in music.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's how I originally got into journalism, magazines. I was just obsessed with music, and I started out writing at and interning at the Boston Phoenix, which is actually still exists. But it's
I'm a Boston. Used to go to school there. I know the Phoenix well.
Right. So I started out as an intern at the Phoenix.
The Rat? Was that the old spot?
Yeah, the Rat is classic. The Phoenix, the Rat Skiller.
The Deli House.
Yeah, in Kenmore Square.
Oh, yeah.
So the Phoenix was right around the corner from there. That's like, legendary club where Mission of Burma got their start. All these great bands used to play. So I did that, and then I moved to New York and worked at a bunch of entertainment magazines, Entertainment Weekly and Spin and Rolling Stone. And, that's how I just originally got into journalism. I sort of, was a music fan first and then fell in love with magazines and writing and editing and what all magazines do. But then a year and a half ago, took kind of a left turn and went over to Food & Wine to become an editor.
Did you see the job opening? I mean, it's one of those things, it's a big... I guess I take that back. Having done this show now for a number of years, it's not that big of a stretch of imagination, but do they just see, he's a great editor, great writer, he obviously has a pedigree, and you just had to... how did that transition happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I had to prove my sort of food bona fides, that I knew something, that I knew the difference between, Thomas Keller and Daniel Boulud, and that I could that I knew enough about cooking and how restaurants work and how recipes work, and enough about food to prove that I could just go in there. I mean, And I just basically did because food, this whole time that I was working in other magazines, has just been my personal passion. It's what I do on the weekends. I'll spend a whole day making a seafood paella. I'll like cook, you know, a ton of David Tanis recipes. Like, you know, I love cookbooks. So I used to work in kitchens. And
what kitchens did you work in?
All bad catering kitchens in Boston, like horrible, really? Horrible kosher caterers.
Give us a horror story. You don't have to name anybody.
No, the worst was just like, the worst was the kosher caterer I worked for that was just like, the food is reused like over and over again. It's like, oh, just put those egg rolls back in and we'll heat them up for next weekend. Oh. Just like that kind of stuff is just common. Oh. It's really demeaning, depressing work, but I don't know.
Would you see people be like, this food is amazing? And you're like, oh, it was made 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone ever said this food is amazing. That didn't happen so much. But, you know, that was how I sort of helped pay my bills when I was a struggling freelance writer, you know, in the late 90s, making 5 cents a word, writing live reviews for the Boston Phoenix. So,
favorite Boston show?
Favorite Boston show?
That you went to.
Wow. I remember seeing a really early Eminem show, which was amazing before his album came out, and I was very into hip hop then, and it was just amazing and powerful, and I was like, who is this person?
Wow.
So that's one that really stands out.
That's pretty good. I would say it's pretty good. So Dick catering on the side, you're writing on the side, and then you also said you worked at one notable place though.
When I was growing up, I grew up in Michigan, I worked at this deli called Zingerman's, which is a really famous
Jewish style deli.
Yeah, kind of. It's cool is that they're Jewish, but they also do, like, they import their own cheese, and they do have an amazing cheese program. They were really pioneers in sort of making everything from scratch, importing this great stuff from Italy and from France and from Spain that you couldn't get anywhere else. And, you know, for a long time, there were not a lot of people who did this. And what was cool also about the menu was that they were like, okay, we're going to make this idealized corned beef sandwich. We're going to cure the corned beef ourselves. But then they also do, like, Italian style subs, and they do, you know, the most amazing, they have a BLT menu of like 20 BLTs every summer. It's just a great place. So I learned a lot more about sort of quality food and working there than I did in my catering days.
Did your parents cook?
My parents are good cooks, really good. My dad is like, he's a professor and he's crazy organized. And so every Sunday he would like, you know, map out like every single dinner of the week. Like on like a menu, and then like, you know, and like write it all down. He's just very organized. So yeah.
That's amazing. Were they pumped about the Food and Wine transfer?
Yeah, I think they were. Though my parents were sort of old hippies, so they appreciated the Rolling Stone thing a lot. You know, they're lefties and old hippies, so I think they actually still get Rolling Stone, which is sort of nice. They still subscribe even after I left. But yeah, they were very pumped about Food and Wine, and they've been happy to live off, you know, some of the extra wine and scotch and things I get.
All right, well, we're going to play another couple tracks off the comp that comes out tomorrow, and then we're going to talk about how big food mags are in today's current scene and the relevance of going to print versus being able to read something online.
All right.
Sound good?
That sounds good.
All right, you're listening to Snacky Tunes. We're your hosts, Greg and Darren Bresnitz.
Things we didn't say. So
we are in studio with the wonderful Michael Endelman talking about Food and Wine and magazines, and he just let us know about his short stint at Zingerman's Deli. Did you get to take home any of the meats and cheeses? Did they give you, like, what was staff lunch?
I got a lot of meats and cheeses.
Did you work the slicer at all? Were you, like, did you get to make sandwiches?
Yeah, I can work a slicer.
Yeah?
I mean, if this magazine thing all dies, if digital kills print, I can always go back to the deli.
I think the three of us have all worked, because I used to work at a place called Dakota Pizza, and they would make their own turkeys and then cool them, and they'd have this, like, giant layer of fat around them, and I would slice it and just be covered in turkey fat.
Yeah.
Congealed.
The thing that the smelliest part was actually like the pickle barrels. I remember when you'd have to change out the pickle barrel when you got rid of all the pickles, and it was just, there was just no way to do it without just getting covered in pickle juice. And actually I actually worked once in a pickle factory in Israel, and that is the absolute worst, because you just end up soaked in brine.
I mean, you're just like in, you, it's in the skin.
You're pickled. You're just pickled.
Can you eat pickles now?
Love pickles.
Has that passed? So, before the show started, you were telling us how it's a pretty busy week for you because your September issue is getting kicked out the door, going to print.
Right.
It is June. I believe a lot of things will probably happen between now and September.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about where print magazines kind of sit and juxtapose against food blogs, and what the core strengths are of a food magazine versus something like an Eater or Grub.
Sure. I mean, you know, I kind of just feel like they have entirely different goals for the most part. You know, something like Eater, say, is just trying to keep you up to date with all of this kind of gossip and news about, you know, national or low regional chefs, restaurants, bars, what's going on in your city now, who said what's opening, what's closing, what's hot, what's not, all that. And they do an awesome job at that. Something that a food magazine does like Food and Wine is this more... It's trying to do lots of things. It's trying to inspire you to cook. It's trying to, like, teach you about more in depth about cooking and how to cook. It's trying to teach you more long read profiles about chefs and winemakers. It's trying to, like, it's like a different experience. It's this, you know, reading a magazine is like this more luxurious experience where you sit down, hopefully, and you read it, you flip through it, you look at the photos. I mean, photos, food styling, all the recipe testing, all that stuff is a huge part of what we do. And so, like, hopefully you're kind of like, it's more immersive in that way, whereas something that's online it's just more quick hit, and it's trying to interest you in the moment. This is something hopefully that, you know, inspires you both visually and kind of, you know, through the words to cook and to learn more about food and wine.
And obviously with blogs, I don't even consider that setting time aside. I see it as something that happens, but when I sit down with a Food and Wine or any sort of magazine like that, it's dedicated time to read and to sort of intake that knowledge.
Right. I think, you know, magazines are not going to be ever as popular as they were, but this whole idea that just because their blogs, food blogs are popular, I mean, food magazines can't be popular is just crazy. We do really different things. I mean, I don't think anyone's going to tell you that looking at Eater is like a really great visual experience. I mean, they use pickup photos they get from wherever.
I mean, do you feel that food blogs are good for the food scene?
Yeah, I mean, I think generally I do. I think that, you know, they, I mean, I love, you know, in the same way that Gawker kind of changed the media landscape in some way, or even the Pitchfork did for music journalism, like, it, I think it is sort of forcing people to try different things and to try to be more, to try to create an experience that feels really unique and different. I mean, we think really hard about, okay, like, so this is a great story, like, we have a great narrative here, but what's it going to look like? What's this kind of, like, this aesthetic, what's this vibe that we're going to create with the photos and stuff that's going to really be, just going to, like, really be beautiful and going to kind of get people excited. So we think a lot about trying to make this experience of reading a magazine really different than what people are experiencing, you know, on their iPhone or on their computer at work.
Is there a certain calmness in the office then? Do you know, like, versus,
I
like,
wish.
Yeah. Do you know, but you know what I'm saying? The way that you say it, it's like, we sit, we have the finest scotch laid out in front of Norwegian lox, and we go,
No. I wish we could say that we sit down and we crack open, you know, verticals of DRC from Burgundy and sit and talk about the evolution of wine. But no, it's kind of crazy, just like any office is. But I do think, you know, you asked, like, so we're shipping September now, and clearly it's June, but we're not a news magazine. You know, if if the Supreme Court strikes down Obamacare, like, it doesn't really matter
right.
whether about food and wine. If
You're still going to want to shave truffles onto the end of your dish.
Exactly. But you guys, exactly.
But you guys do have a blog component.
Right. I mean, that's the
brand.
That's the idea, is that, you know, we the magazine serves one focus, one side of it. And then we have a very active website and blog, and hopefully, you know, we have an email newsletter which, you know, is hitting people up with recipes every day or every right. week. We do a blog which is more reactive to news and interviews, and so that we are hitting, you know, hopefully you have this kind of 360 feeling where you're hitting people every day with stuff, you're hitting people once a week, and then you hit them once a month with this, you know, this great product, this beautiful product.
And I mean, I don't want to say talk numbers, but across the all the mediums that you hit people with, the email, with the website, with that, have you seen a growth in readership?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, our circulation, you know, the subscriptions of the numbers is going up. But then, you know, just the amazing growth, you know, 5-10 years ago, we did not have an email newsletter.
Right.
You know, we now have one that reaches, I can't even say, because I don't know. I have no idea.
No, I would.
I'm bad with the numbers. But, you know, we reach millions of people more through Facebook and Twitter and all that stuff. And, you know, I mean, it's, I don't know. It's a different kind of thing. It's hard to say, you know, you don't make as much money from that stuff, but it's all part of this brand. And, you know, then Food and Wine's also got a big foot in the food festival world. We do them in Aspen, and we license and do them with all kinds of people.
I've heard nothing but good things about the Aspen.
Aspen is
and
amazing.
It just happened. Were you out there?
I was not, I have been, and it's Aspen is amazing, and it is.
What sets it apart from the other ones?
I don't know. I haven't been. I mean, I've only been to some local things, so I can't really say. But they get amazed. They get really, really top quality people, you know, from Jacques Pepin to more Carlo from Roberta's was there last year. They get great, great people, and they have really high quality seminars. I mean, the people who go really are interested, let's say, in learning about wine. You can go to a Barolo seminar and do these tastings of Barolos with like David Lynch, who's this great sommelier out in San Francisco, who really knows. Not that David Lynch, but a different David Lynch, who really knows Italian wine, wrote a book on Italian wine, and so you can kind of get that experience. You're getting that's I think that's why people go, and that's what makes it awesome.
Do you think that the different regions, like where it is, because it kind of maybe grabs the best of the East and the best of the West, and kind of puts them in the middle of the country?
I mean, Aspen, yeah, Aspen is just kind of like, you know, that's where people who like to live the fine life just go to hang out and party.
Is there a difference between those people and then East Coast and West Coast people?
You mean in who go to Aspen?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. I mean, it gets definitely a much more. I mean, the crowds at Aspen Food and Wine are really different than the crowd you're going to see at Smorgasburg or Brooklyn Flea.
Or South Beach.
It's really different. You know, I think sometimes in like the kind of Brooklyn bubble, we forget that like a lot of the people who are driving this kind of interest in food are not like, you know, are older and have, you know, people. That's the thing, is that they're you know, these are people in their 40s and 50s who actually have a lot of money to spend on food and wine, and they're like part of what's like driving this whole.
Oh no, it's not something that people should really forget. Like, I think food is hip only in the last 3 to 5 years, but the people who really float the whole scene is bankers and whatnot.
And yeah, I mean, and just, you know, people who have that kind of, you know, money to spend and care about deeply about food, just, you know, they don't like fit into the like kind of Brooklyn demo.
Okay. We're going to play another song.
Yeah.
And then we're going to talk about what makes a great food and wine story. And then best worst interviews in music and food, which I'm actually really curious about. And then maybe some other, you know, hard-hitting questions, which is, you know, our total interview style. You're listening to Snacky Tunes.
She left me alone with no word. out there for all of us. Buddy Bone. There's one out there for me and you.
So, Michael.
Yeah.
What makes a great food and wine story?
What makes a great food and wine story? Well, you know, we're always trying to be sort of at the cutting edge. So we're always trying to find stories that are new and haven't been told before. You know, we're also trying to always find people who, like, you know, or feel like they're just pushing forward in the world of food. We that's like one thing we're always driving to do is every month we'll give our readers something new that they haven't heard of that feels like it's a trend and it's going to be the next big thing. And so that's something that we're always really important with. And then there's that other visual element. We're just trying to find these stories that look cool, whether, you know, it's like a dynamic chef or just a beautiful restaurant or a beautiful home or some great, you know, setting. And then, I mean, the last thing, which I think people talk about food magazines, they actually forget, is like we publish, you know, I don't know, over 30 recipes a month, and that they're just, they all work and they're great.
Right.
Like we have like a staff of like five, six people whose jobs it is to test recipes. And like, you'd be surprised when a chef of your favorite restaurant turns in a recipe, like it's not always very good. Like something doesn't translate from the restaurant kitchen to the home kitchen.
I work a lot in television. It's the same thing. It's just what might work at a big level for a restaurant.
Yeah, it just doesn't work.
It just doesn't work.
I mean, when you're cooking on a professional stove and you're cooking 100 at a time, sure, but when you have to like do it for a family of four, yeah, you know, for six servings. So, you know, I cook from the magazine all the time. And like,
what's your favorite recipe found from there?
The one I made most recently, which was this crazy project, was Seamus Mullen of Tertulia,
yeah,
has this great seafood paella, but you make it on a big Weber grill, on a big like 18 inch cast iron, a big, not a carbon steel pan, like a paella pan.
Yeah.
And It was a lot. I mean, it was like, you know, you boil a lobster, you shell it, then you make a lobster stock, and then you know that you boil down and infuse with saffron and a sofrito and all this stuff, and it was great.
I mean, that's an all day thing.
I mean, you know, it actually wasn't so bad. It was like, you know, I have kids, so I'm like, I got a crazy hyper organized. I think like, you know, I'd like, you know, 3 days before I make my stock, 2 days before I make my sofrito. Like I got it.
Your
all.
Dad is quietly nodding. Yes. Like, yes, that's right, son.
You know, like I read that Thomas Keller ad hoc book, which is an amazing cookbook.
It's amazing.
So, and that one really instilled in me, like, it's all about, you know, cooking is like half about like discipline, organization. And I'm not a great cook in anyways, but I'm a good home cook. And so I've been trying to like, you know, learn lessons from the master Thomas, like, you know, plan it all out, clean your workspace, keep everything like, you know, spick and span.
One of the favorite recipes I've ever got was Thomas Keller's roast chicken.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Which is just like, I only made it because I didn't believe him that it could be so simple. And I went, well done, Thomas.
Yes. Yeah. You just like put it in the oven, close the door, crank it up, and don't touch
it. Yeah. And yeah, just like leave it alone.
Yeah, leave it alone.
Leave it alone. So we were just talking during the break, that like how easy it is to kind of get a handle on chefs versus musicians. And I know that you've interviewed both over the years. So like,
yeah.
Let's start with what are some of like the best interviews you've had for food and for music?
Okay. I haven't done enough ton of food interviews to know, but I have done a lot. I did, you know, a dozen years in the kind of music journalism trenches. And, you know, I think I have a few worst interviews ever. And some of them they're musicians I love for the most part. They're just like, they were bad. I mean, I think the absolute worst was Timbaland. And this was sort of, I think, pre-Justin Timberlake when he was sort of more just hip-hop producer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he was in the studio when I was talking to him, and I would ask a question. And then, like, I think he put the phone down for a while. And, like, I could hear him talking to people and, like, mixing tracks. And then he'd pick it up again, and he'd say, what? And then I'd ask a question, and he would go like, uh-huh. And he would just sort of say, uh-huh. And then he would like put the phone down again. And I mean, I think I got more than like four or five syllables over 45 minutes. And so that was the absolute worst interview I think I've ever had.
What magazine was it for?
That was for Entertainment Weekly. And I don't even really remember the story.
Right.
I have no idea.
What story?
It was unusual.
What story?
It
seemed like you had a lot of questions.
I had a lot of questions, and I really got never more than a few syllables.
We asked him the questions.
He was kind of, he's become a little more slick now, but you know, like, in his early days, he was kind of infamous for the one-syllable answer.
He got that media training.
Yeah, I think after that Timberlake album hit big, he got that media training. And
yeah, someone was like, "Hey, man, you gotta if you're gonna be up there with Timbo,
yeah, you gotta answer some questions."
So what's one of your best music ones?
I mean, sometimes some of the best people are not like Wayne Coyne is classic. Wayne Coyne is just amazing interview. He'll answer any question. He'll also give you some crazy answer. He'll tell you all sorts of things you don't want to know about, but they're always entertaining. So Wayne Coyne is just sort of like
what?
I mean, he's just kooky and weird, and will talk about anything. And he'll tell you about all the drugs he's taken, and he's down. He'll also like tell you all about the people he doesn't like. He's totally happy to piss on people, which no one really likes to do anymore.
Really? So he doesn't seem like the type of guy that pisses on people.
He does. He's kind of he has.
I can see guys
got
shit on and marginalized for a number of years.
Do they have a big chip on his shoulder?
No, I don't think so. I just think he's just real and opinionated. But I actually loved him. I spent a weekend with Lil Jon in Miami, in South Beach, like living with him for a weekend, doing a story for him. This is all aging me because these are all artists who are not popular anymore. But Lil Jon was big at one time. He had, you know, yeah, that whole thing.
Yeah.
And he was, it was more just like he let me into his life and he didn't care. I was there all weekend with him, like literally like just living with him and following him around to the club and drinking out of his crunk chalice and all this insane stuff and going to eat pizza with him and Ludacris at 4 a.m. And he was just down with it. And he just was opened up his life and he was very cool about it.
That's anything awesome. Shocking there?
No, I mean, it was kind of like the cliche of a rapper in South Beach that you expect. I mean, it was like...
No punches were pulled.
No. I mean, it was just exactly what you expect. He actually didn't... I think maybe the secret was that he didn't drink that much and party that hard in the end. Like, he would go out to the club, but he wasn't...
Yeah, we have a term for it called show party.
Yeah, definitely a show party. I mean, he had a bodyguard who carried his crunk chalice for him in a silver case. So it was clearly a show.
Right. Yeah. Know? Yeah. But, you know, sometimes he would just drink out of a sippy cup.
Yeah.
You know, that's fine. And then, so let's food, which I, you know, we won't hold you to. We'll say, I mean, this is where you started, and then 5 years from now, we'll be like, oh
yeah,
my God.
I mean, you know, I haven't had any real horrible ones yet, so I can't really talk to that. You guys maybe know better than me. I mean, Tony Bourdain, of course, is great, but that's not a secret. The guy I loved was Paul Bortolotta, who mm-hmm. runs this amazing over... He's from the Midwest, and he runs this amazing seafood restaurant in Vegas called Bortolotta. And it's like a recreation of a Venetian seafood palace. He flies in like millions of dollars of fish from Italy every single day.
What?
And he's an amazing chef. And he was one of those guys who literally sat down at the table and was like, "What do you want to know?" And talked for like 2 hours. And, you know, literally like would show me his receipts for the night. And he's like, he was willing to open up his books financially, which very few people really want to do. And is maybe not really something I needed for a story, but he was like one of these guys who was just like so open and opinionated and would, and just like wanted to talk and share his story. And I thought he was awesome.
So, as we kind of wrap this up, I wanted to know what advice you would like to give people who are kind of want to get into your world, considering the fact that you made the transition. It'd be one thing if you'd been like always been a food writer and you just kind of, but you obviously built your own pedigree and then were able to have your own skills and to swap. I was like, what would you recommend people start to do that's actually valuable versus what might be perceived as valuable?
Right. I mean, my advice is like very old school. I mean, it's like the skills you build as a journalist, they should be translatable to no matter what you do. So like learning how to like, you know, research and report and edit and write and interview, like it could be like Animal Collective, or it could be like Mario Batali. Like those skills are kind of the same, you know, like you have to bring those like those journalistic skills to the table no matter what you do. And so that's just basically it. It's like, you know, when you're young, just write as much as you possibly can, even if it doesn't pay. Like, you have to just write, and then you have to learn, like, you have to find people who are willing to teach you, like, what you're doing wrong.
Right.
I mean, like, that was the thing is, when I was young, it was just like, every story was, like, torn apart, and like, this is not good, you need to do it again, and doing it, it's, I mean, in that way, writing is sort of like cooking in a restaurant. It's more of a craft than an art. I mean, at least in the beginning, like there's a craft to writing. It's like you have to do it over and over and over again to learn how to do it. You know, the only way to do it, to learn how to do an interview is like, you just got to do like 100 of them or 200 of them. And then you're like, oh, okay, now I think
you're
I know.
Oh, I get it. I get the rhythm.
Right. Like, you know, you got, you know, I mean, every time you sit down to an interview, you're like thinking a million things at once. You have your list of questions and then you got to think about the, how much time you have. And then you have to listen to them, but you also have to like, and so you want to respond to them, but you also have to get to all your questions. I mean, it's like, it's this crazy art of learning how to do it. And people who are great can kind of do all those things at once. And there's just,
or
just,
have a twin brother.
Or have a twin brother.
Oh, which is a secret.
Yeah.
Do you have a mentor shout out?
I mean, I have a, I've been lucky. I've had a bunch of mentors over the years. I mean, I had an original mentor at the Boston Phoenix. This guy, Matt Asher, who, you know, I was his intern and he was basically showed me how to get started. Jason Fine was my editor at Rolling Stone, was great. He's now at Men's Journal. He's an awesome guy and a great editor. Great. So I learned a lot from those guys.
Can I ask, who's more obsessive, movie buffs, music nerds, or food lovers?
I actually think music people are the most hardcore. Like I know Dylan nuts. I know people who are like, you know, obsessed with, you know, French psychedelic rock from the 60s. I mean, like those, that kind of thing,
like esoteric.
Like when you're like, I feel like those people who are searching and searching and searching for these live tapes. Or I did a story years ago on people who go around, you know, the people who go around tape shows, like jam band shows. I mean, and they do this like every night of their life. And sometimes it's like they just love taping shows. And I felt like I haven't met that kind of obsession.
Do you think they're all chasing this one moment that they're trying to lock in?
I mean, that's the kind of irony of people who tape shows, is that they're trying to chase this like great show, but in a weird way, they're so worried about their gear that they're not actually listening to the shows until later.
Right.
I actually found them very sad. But
there was that New York Times article a few years ago about these people who go to like Brighton Beach to find caviar or something like that, and just it seemed like to suck all the fun out of dinner parties,
right?
And that obsessive nature, I feel that's sort of the same thing. And then I feel it goes beyond actually enjoying what it is, just bragging rights or something like that,
right? I mean, they're I mean, you know, I have to say though, on the other hand, people who are crazy about wine might take the cake, because wine collectors are. I mean, not is the funny thing about wine. I mean, wine collectors have that added thing, is that they're really stinking rich usually. So like they have the money to pursue insane dreams.
But I would say that you don't even consume what you're chasing. It just sits somewhere.
No. Those guys who buy the big wine, they do those things where they'll go out with like six other big guys.
I mean,
guys.
If you buy 10, or they buy 10 cases of it, and so they put away 8.5 and drink, you know.
There was that great story in New York Magazine, I think, about the wine guy from AC who was creating fake bottles and things.
Rudy Kanawian, I think it's called. Yeah, who's in prison now. That's an amazing story. I mean, this guy, it shows how easy it was, but people want to believe that
They
want to believe that this
I mean,
is,
and then after all that stuff, they want to believe that. And I love when they get this house, and it was just like a giant empty house.
Yeah, it was like a counterfeit plant.
With just bottles and labels. It's amazing.
Yeah, but, I don't know. I just found like people who are obsessed with music and obsessed with like, there's this intensity there where they're searching for some kind of experience or like some inner thing that somehow seems deeper than people who are just like, I don't know, on a barbecue tour of Alabama or something.
Yeah, like if you go to the good place that is popular because it's good, it's not as, you know, they'll go to some really terrible roadside shack, but because it was such a haul and destination, they go, right. Oh, it's so good and so amazing. They're like, eh. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's bragging rights. It gets a little tiresome after a while.
Yeah. But, you know, I think we were talking like before that the food music journalism crossover, what's interesting is how accessible. So what's sort of fun about the food world now is that still in a lot of places, chefs are super accessible. If you want to know a story about them, they'll let you come into their kitchen. They'll let you like follow them around for a week. Where in, you know, music, that kind of thing, everyone has like a publicist, and it's very hard.
Try booking this show. I mean, and like not for anything, but like for bands that are like very new, where just like, hey, I'd like to do half an hour publicity. We'll give you three live songs, all that stuff. Like, eh.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny. There's that ambivalence about press.
But chefs
want people to come to their restaurants.
Please eat at my restaurant. Come on Monday.
Yeah,
I will shake your hand.
Yeah, they're excited. They're excited to talk to you. They're excited to share what you're doing. And so there's something uplifting and fun about that, to just go to these people who want to share what they're like. I do this amazing thing. I want to share it with you. Not like, Oh, yeah, I guess I can give you a 10-minute phoner on Tuesday.
Right.
Yeah. Can you call me? I'm going to be in Sydney, so can you call me? It'll be 3 a.m. your time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, you know, I mean, I don't know who it is. I mean, Animal Collective, for instance, they're like, those guys hate doing interviews, and they're miserable, and, like, you know, like, they're the worst interview ever. And it's like, oh, it's so depressing to have to try to do a story with someone who doesn't want to talk to you.
No, but you have to because the public demands it.
Right, because the public demands it.
Final question.
Yeah.
Dream story.
Dream
food.
Okay, dream food story?
Yeah.
You
can, and you can do it for bragging rights, don't feel that you
mean have, like, so this is supposed to be a story that I know exists and that I want to do?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I think it would be, you know what would be really cool is I would want to try to get inside a chef, someone who's hyper creative. Like a Thomas Keller or a Grant Achatz or something, and try to really understand, like, through spending time with them in the kitchen, like, how do you get inspired to create, like, this one dish, you know? And almost to the point of, like, real nerdy, like, why is this little cube of, like, hibiscus jelly here and not here? Like, why, how do you figure out, like, what, and, like, this is not, I don't know if this is a story that anyone wants to read, but I think I would be fascinated with sort of, like, how do you decide that, like, to do this exact thing and to put everything in this exact order, and where does that all come from? And to sort of, like, try to understand those layers of meaning and understanding, like, you know, Thomas Keller could tell you, well, you know, when I worked at this restaurant in France, he did this thing with mackerel, which I always loved, and so then when I see mackerel, I think of this. And I kind of like how those, like, years of experience and decades of experience kind of translate into creating something new. You know, cause, like, that, and that only happens at a real high level of chefdom. You know, most chefs are not don't do that sort of thing. But that would be, like, an amazing thing to do.
I would read that, and only read that. You could easily make that a series,
sure,
with a great photo and then how it's deconstructed.
But it's amazing how you could do that in 1,000 words or 10,000 words.
Yeah, I mean, you could go really deep.
I mean, you could go really, really deep.
I don't think 10,000 words. 1,000 words would be good.
20,000 words.
I don't want to read.
A whole article of Food and Wine dedicated to one dish.
Yes.
That'd actually be kind of amazing.
A single dish issue would be amazing.
That would actually be where you, like, where it's sourced and the people behind the... That's actually pretty amazing. Hey.
Maybe I'll take that back to the office.
It's pretty good.
You're welcome.
I'll let you guys know.
Yeah. Michael, we want to thank you for being on the show.
Guys, thank you very much.
This was awesome. You want to give us the nuts and bolts of people... Can people write you? No, you can say
I
no.
don't know.
Foodandwine.com.
I'm on Twitter at Michael Endelman.
That's good.
And
that's good.
I'm an addict, so if you tweet at me, then I will receive and
okay.
I will respond.
Is that how I just set up a squash game?
Yeah. Well, you also have my email.
I do have your email.
But yes.
He didn't just show up.
Also, if you are like a decent 3.0, 3.5 player, yeah, I'm down.
I'm around 3.0, 3.5. On a good day, I'm a 4.0.
Okay. And I'm definitely not a 4.0.
And if I haven't, it's the first weekend. Like, after the weekend is always the...
Right. Also, if there's anyone listening who's into squash, I'm really always looking for partners.
Yeah, let's do this.
Let's do this.
That could be someone's entry point.
Yeah.
They could try...
I mean, what? Actually, I'm going to be open this up, too. Like, if you're a writer and you want to pitch me, tweet me. And I'm, like, half... A big part of my job is working with freelance writers. I love working with new writers and new talent. And, you know, of the pitches I get, you know... Probably, you know, 98% of them don't work, but there's always, like, a few that do and that are interesting. And, you know, and I think people also think that when you pitch a magazine or an editor, it's like, oh, I'm pitching them this presented final product. But in reality, the story, all things always evolve.
Yeah.
And so it's like one idea becomes another idea and evolves into something else. And
like,
so,
like a one dish issue.
Like a one dish issue. So please, if you have pitches, I can't believe I'm saying this. I'm probably going to regret this, but please pitch me.
You might regret it till you get that one article that you wouldn't have gotten any other way. And
that's
then...
true. That's true. I mean, a lot of writers I work with are not... I mean, there's a writer I work with right now who just was a friend of someone who's an MFA guy and works at Christie's in the wine department, and he's an awesome writer. Just,
amazing.
Yeah.
Hey, you never know. And that's what's shorter than an elevator pitch than a tweet pitch?
Nothing.
Right?
Oh, yeah. 140 characters.
140 characters.
Pitch me 140 characters.
But that would actually be... That's actually kind of amazing. You know what? If you get any good ones, please send them to me.
Yeah, I will.
We'll read them on air. All right. Well, thank you all for listening. Just a reminder that Snacky Tunes Live comes out tomorrow.
Woo-hoo!
Free download. Go to FOTPNYC.com. If you go tonight, it'll probably be up there because I've got to upload it.
And then don't forget about the City Winery Barbecue Blowout. You can get tickets at citywinery.com.
Or Thrillist.com
for the VIP hour. Eight chefs, Tyler Boring, David Burke, Garrett Oliver, Big Gay Ice Cream Truck, and more. Plus bands from Snacky Tunes, Rewards, Fletcher C. Johnson,
and we're going to DJ.
And we're going to DJ, and so Alex Pasternak. Michael, thank you again for joining
guys,
us.
Guys, thanks so much.
And we'll be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes.
Listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.